My name is Clint, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm going to have a seat here so I don't get distracted. Most people that know me know that I have a problem talking and yapping and not shutting up. In fact, most people that know me tell me, will you please shut the hell up? And then there's other people who pay me to talk really, really fast. So I'm kind of in a contradiction here. But it really easy to do something that doesn't have anything to do with personal life, my personal issues, things I've been through, things that I've done. So this is a little difficult for me. I've only done this one at a time in Fresno. And so I'm going to attempt it again, so please bear with me. Right out of high school, like most people, let me back up a little farther than that. My earliest memories, I don't have any memories before the age of 12 years old, none whatsoever. My brother's 14 months older than I am, and he has no memory whatsoever from probably the age of 13, before, until the age of 13, no memories whatsoever. Christmas, holidays, nothing. Family, pictures, dogs. I can see a picture that I know that it's me, but I have no recollection that that ever took place. And I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I do know that I was raised in an alcoholic home. And I know that that's not what made me an alcoholic, but those were my earliest memories. I remember growing up at a young age thinking, and this was probably, this is old thinking, it's not my thinking today, but the thinking then was that I was conceived out of drunkenness. It was an accident. We weren't really supposed to be around. We were a pain in the ass. We were, in an alcoholic home, it was very dysfunctional. Let me just say that for a beginning. My earliest recollection with my father, then my parents divorced. My mother married the next 5 alcoholics that she met in a row. Within days of meeting him, she'd marry him. And my father has married 4 more times also. So I think one of the hardest things for me in getting clean and sober was stepping out of my comfort zone. And my comfort zone with that kind of a family life was living hell. It was miserable. Chaos was normal to me. I remember dating people that were just normal and just wanted to have fun in life, and it was so abnormal to me that I had to do something to change that because it just wasn't comfortable for me. So it kind of made it real hard for me to attempt to get clean and sober. And I'm not making excuses. It's just what happened to me. Being a little lost as a kid with not a whole lot of family guidance and people that really took interest in your young lives, I had to find other avenues to entertain myself. And I remember in high school, probably my sophomore or junior year at Bullard High School, as everybody does, I can imagine most people, they experiment or try alcohol or try beer or try other things. I remember the very first time that I ever drank, it took away any insecurities, any fears, and I do hear a lot of people saying that. But for the first time in my life, I didn't feel out of place. I didn't feel abnormal. I didn't feel alone. I didn't feel unloved. It was probably the first time in my life that I actually felt alive. I remember as a kid watching men walk down the street with their sons holding hands, and I thought, what's the matter with them? It was just so foreign to me. And that made for a rough start. That made for a rough start, and it made for a rough road to try and get clean and sober. So once I started, I remember the first night. I worked at a place called Fresno Dotson. It's not there now. Back when the Dotson D2 pins used to first came out, they had the honeycomb design on the side of them and the hubcaps. It's been a long time ago. I played baseball for this team, and this was when I was a kid, my first experience. These were all grown men, and I was just a kid in high school, and they kind of took me under their wing, and I played on their softball baseball team, and after one of the games they won, they were all celebrating, and they took me back to this house. The guy's name was Bud Anderson. I'll never forget him. He had huge spider web tattoos on his elbows. He was missing a few teeth, and he ran guard dogs, pit bulls, security dogs for a living. But he was as nice a man as I've ever met, and what he did to me wasn't intentional. But he took me under his wing, and he brought me over there to play after the baseball game and offered me a beer. And I was just a young kid, and I thought, man, this is really cool. And I noticed everybody at that time was going to the back room for a little while to come back out. And to make a long story short, in that aspect, and because this is an AA meeting, it was the first time I tried other substances. And it was actually the first time I tried cocaine. And I don't mean any disrespect to A, it's just part of my story. And I spent, I felt so good that night for the first time in my life. I was drinking, I was high, and I spent 28 years trying to get that feeling back. I spent 28 years trying to feel like I felt that night. I'll never forget that feeling. I honestly spent probably the next 10 years trying to find that guy again. Probably in prison, I don't know. But I honestly spent at least 10 years looking all over Fresno. He wasn't in the guard dog business anymore, security business. But I looked for him for years because I wanted that feeling back again. I wanted to feel good again. I never ran into him again, but there was a whole bunch of Bud Andersons out there. He wasn't the only one. I don't think there's anything I haven't tried other than, you know, besides alcohol, and I'll stick with the alcohol, but, you know, as I look back, I have driven drunk so many times and got home, like a lot of people talk about, in blackouts and wonder, or actually go outside and your car's not there, or wake up not knowing where you're at. That was just a way of life for me. That's just what I did. That was so normal. That's just what we did. And to not have to feel, to be able to numb that void, that emptiness in my chest, I'm 47 years old. And I just have about a year and a half, and that'll tell you how long it's taken me to undo some of those things that became a way of life for me. Well, you know, when I realized, you know, as a kid, my grandfather died from alcoholism, my great grandfather died from alcoholism, and I think the concept when I was younger was that, and you know, you hear people talk about that, you know, most of our stories, I don't want to say a broken record, but a lot of us have the same insight. I used to think that the people carrying the brown bags and sleeping on the park bench when you go down to City Hall or downtown Fresno, those were the alcoholics. Those were the people that were drunks. And so I didn't really see myself as having a disease. I was raised around it. We had tappers in our living room until I was old to leave the house. My aunts and uncles had tappers in their living room, kegs of beer in their living room. And so my family, as a kid, we spent every night going to their house and them coming to our house. And that's just what they did. And I remember giving my dad a hard time one time about when I finally realized that this was a disease that I possibly inherited, a genetic predisposition. I gave my dad a really hard time. I told him, this is your fault. This is because of you. And one thing he said that I agreed with, he said, you know, that very well may be true, but I've been sober for 20 years now, so if you inherited a gene to get drunk, you also inherited a gene to get sober, because I've been sober for 20 years now. And I kind of gave up the fight with my dad at that point. There was nothing left to argue with him about. It was what he was saying was true. You know, it worked for him, and it worked for a lot of other people. And the last time I spoke in Fresno, they gave me an out. I wasn't able to speak for 45 minutes. They allowed someone else to take over, but I don't think they have that option here, do they, Bill? No. I'm sweating already. I'd much rather be selling something to you for an exorbitant amount of money. I'm comfortable with that. You know, I have a lot of alcoholics, and I tell you my childhood, not because that's what made me an alcoholic. And as I mentioned earlier, it's just my story. It's just what I went through. It had nothing to do with why I turned out to be an alcoholic. I have a disease of alcoholism, and it has nothing to do with alcohol. When I include alcohol in my disease, and I'm off and running. It's so nice not to have that miserable, pitiful, and incomprehensible demoralization of my life on a daily basis today that, you know, I go to work laughing, and sometimes the guy that I work with wonders, what the hell are you so happy about today? I'm so happy to be alive, and I know I'm jumping here just a little bit. I partied with my brother most of my childhood. We both had the same, obviously the same conditions when we were raised. A couple of traumatics. I always wonder why it took me so long, and I know it takes what it takes to get clean and sober. But I had several layers that I had to work through, and I've experienced a couple of traumatic things that happened, and I don't think I've probably shared these before. family member tried to take her life when I was a kid, when I was about 15. I'd got my driver's license, so I had to take her to the hospital. And that was pretty traumatic. It was kind of overwhelming as a kid to have those feelings of someone trying to commit suicide in my presence and then having to deal with the aftermath of that. And it caused a lot of chaos in my life. And then shortly after that, I was doing some construction work. Because, you know, when you're drinking and doing other issues, it was kind of hard to be dependable. So I got into the construction trade because you could work for a while and then not work for a while and work for a while. You know, if you were handy with your hands, there was always work available. And you could be a little inconsistent in your mannerisms and your daily approach and still find work. I was remodeling a house out in Centerville. I don't know if you know where that's out. Out on the Kings River, there's a gravel pit. One of my mother's husbands, we were moving into a house out on Centerville on the Kings River. And there was no phones. There was electricity, but no phones or cell phones weren't popular back then. I don't know if they were around. If they were, you couldn't carry them very far because they were pretty good size. I was remodeling the house, and the guy my mom was going to marry came out, and he had a heart attack and died that day. And I can remember for a long time after that, I stayed drunk for a long period of time. You know, I think the strongest memory I have at that time, and it's important because those things that happen, I have to heal by talking about. When people die of a heart attack, it's not like you see on TV. They just don't go and fall over. And I remember there was just the two of us there, and it took a long time for somebody else to come out to the house where we were. And it seemed like forever. I don't know how long it was, but it seemed like forever. And a gentleman, Ray, died of a heart attack while I was there with him. And I stayed drunk and high for several years after that. And it was a very traumatic experience for me. It didn't make me an alcoholic, but how I responded to it, how I responded to different issues in my life, I don't say that's not a normal response because that was pretty rough at the time. But I guess my point is that I learned how to not deal with at a very young age. Drinking and doing drugs got me out of feeling hurt, pain, chaos. I've been to a couple of funerals recently, and it's been the first time in my life, and I mean in my life, that I could go to a funeral and not have to drink afterwards or drink before because I knew what I was going to feel like while I was there. Those are uncomfortable feelings for me going to places like that. I've actually been to two, and I was actually honored to be clean and sober to able to go and support the people that I knew. That was a very nice feeling. I've been to two inpatient programs. And I've been through three outpatient programs. And I drank and used through all of them. I don't think. Probably the longest I stayed clean and sober out of getting out of a rehab was probably 4 or 5 months. Probably the longest time. I still remember it because I probably damaged a few brain cells during that period of time. You know, life is so good today that I want to cut to the good stuff. I want to jump, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm so excited about what it's like now that I want to tell you about that, but I guess I need to tell you how I got to that point. You know, I don't have, Evie was here last week, and it was nice. She's told her story before, and it was nice, and this is kind of new for me, so I'm struggling just a little bit. I think one of my other earliest memories, things that I remembered then, what it used to be like, I remembered walking around thinking, yeah, I guess it was easy to blame other people for what happened to me. I always thought it was everybody else's fault. I gave my family members a hard time for, and I mean no offense by this, I used to tell them that they dumped us into society socially retarded, low functioning skills whatsoever. And you mix that with alcoholism, you have a real handful. I went out of town recently, and I went to Morro Bay for a week with the family. And a guy was at one of the speaker meetings, or one of the meetings I went to, he asked, the topic was, why do you go to meetings? And it was instantaneous for me. I had nowhere else to go. All my drinking and using, there was no doors open. There was no doors open. My family didn't want me. They wouldn't return your phone calls. It was a friend who wouldn't answer your calls. I had a bad habit. My nickname was, back then was No Show. I'd book events to go see somebody or go fishing with a friend or something or to do an auction or to do just about anything. And I wouldn't show up. I had the greatest intentions in the world. And being an alcoholic, you know how that can be. It was a little tough holding true to some of those promises that I made. So I guess what it was like for me was when I started drinking and doing other issues. I don't know if you're like me or not, but when I start, I can't stop. I don't drink for a couple days and then just decide, you know what, I don't want to do that anymore. I'll give you an example. In 2002, I broke my neck. I got hit by a truck and it fractured the bone and ruptured a disc in my neck. And I'm just now coming out of that accident. I woke up in the hospital with IVs in my arms, and I'm just now coming out of that fog. I didn't go out and buy a bottle. I wasn't using when I got hit. I was working for a company for quite some time. And I woke up with IVs in my arms with some good meds from the hospital, and I'm just now coming out of that fog. So when I didn't start intentionally, but any good substance or alcohol that goes in my system, it takes me a long time to be able to stop. 2002 was quite a few years ago. The time before that, I had a major surgery in 1992, I had back surgery. And it took me probably until 98, 99 to stop that time. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. Some people say, well, listen, I had a beer, I was over. I don't try to convince myself that I can have one drink. I know that that's not a possibility for me. I cannot do a little bit of anything. As Charlie's mentioned before, my mind, like his, it lies to me on a regular basis. It tells me it's okay. So what it was like was miserable. When I started, I can't stop. The happiest day in my life was probably when I realized that I have a genetic predisposition. I'm not just an idiot or a spineless guy who doesn't have the willpower to be able to stop doing alcohol or drinking alcohol or doing drugs. When I realized that I'm just not an idiot, that I have a disease that makes it physically and mentally almost impossible when I start to stop. I remember that day. It hasn't been that long ago, but they actually proved that it was a genetic predisposition that you can inherit a gene that makes you predisposed, almost impossible to start when you stop. I used to think, why do I keep doing this? Why do I get back in the car and do the same thing over and over and over again? I didn't understand it. I had the greatest intentions in the world, just having one beer with the guys after work on a Friday night. And it never, ever, I don't know if it's one time that it ever worked that way. It just doesn't for me. I don't know about you, but it doesn't work that way for me. Why I have a driver's license today, why I'm not in jail or in prison, or I should be. As much as I don't like coming and talking in front of a group like this, to honestly be out of jail, to be able to go to work, to have my driver's license, if this is part of what it takes to be able to continue to do those things, I'll come up here and sweat and stumble and mumble every time you ask me to. The difference is just so if you're new, it took me a long time to come out of the fog. It took me a long time to be able to start thinking a little clearer. And you know what? I think in the 28 years, I didn't give it long enough for some of the promises to come through, for some of the things that other people have gone through. I don't think I ever gave it enough time to actually start to happen in my life. I can't tell you how many times In fact, my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in my senior year, just after this gentleman passed away, my father came to pick me up because he heard I was having a hard time, and it was kind of a funny starting for AA. Back then, I wanted to feel important. One time, I'm having a rough time in my life, and you know, just chaos, miserable relationships, just work, everything was just upside down. And my dad came to get me to see if he could help. And I remember I researched it. I asked somebody, and back then Betty Ford was the place to go. And you know, here I don't have a pot to piss in, and I tell my dad that's where I want to go. I need to go there. And when he found out how much it cost, that's not going to happen. It was just, we're done talking about that. I had met a counselor that back then, she charged, I think, $25 an hour, which back then was a pretty good hourly rate. And I told him I'd like to go see her on a regular basis, and when he found out it was $25 an hour, he thought, you know, that's not going to happen either, I'm sorry. And he put me in his truck, and he took me to the village group on Palm and Shaw and dropped me off at Amy. He said, you can get sober here for free. And back then I thought I thought he did me a disservice. I thought I had no value in his eyes, and he took me and dropped me out of a place that was free because he didn't want to spend the money to get me clean and sober. And I was angry for a long time with him. And there's a couple gentlemen here tonight in the village group. And 28 years ago, he took me to a meeting at Palm and Shaw and dropped me off and said, you know, good luck. Little did I know at that time he was doing me the biggest blessing, the biggest favor he could ever do for me. I didn't see it then. And I was still in the fog and angry and had issues. And it was probably a month ago that I actually got to go and speak at the village group. The only other time that I've done this. And my father was in the front row. In fact, he called me last night. And my father celebrated 23 years last Thursday. So times have changed. They're different. Sometimes the better. Sometimes they're just different. But there's hope. So 28 years ago, I went to my first meeting of AA. And the thought of people actually being clean and sober, and you hear people say all the time, it's not something new that I've come up with. I didn't think they were telling the truth, because I was never able to do that. I didn't have the concept of not drinking for a month, 2 months, 3 months. That was just almost an impossibility. So I've gotten, you know, I don't know how many times I went to that meeting. I bounced in and out of that meeting for years. I went to a rehab. They sent me back to the village group to go to meetings. The Oxford Family Recovery Group is in Fresno for a little while. I don't think I lasted a month out of getting out of there, back greening again, back to the village group. And it just seems a little funny 28 years later to be going back to the village group. They're not at Palm and Shaw anymore, but I'm actually going back to the same meeting. A lot of those people are still there. The same people that were there 28 years ago are still in that meeting. When I started to decide that something needed to change, when I started going to rehabs to find out what was going on, to try to find out what was going on, peeling some of the layers off the onion, I was just lost. I don't know if you've ever had that in your drinking experience or your other issues. I was just lost. I had no idea. I had been in a fog for so long that I had no idea what to do, but I knew that I needed something. I've been out of meetings so long that a couple of people, one in general, has come up to me and said, oh, it's you again. It was a little kind of weird that day. I've gotten in and out of meetings for 28 years. And when I started reading the book, it said I had to have the desire to want to be clean or to be sober. As long as I had the desire, I had a right to come to the meeting. And when this person said to me, oh, it's you again, for once in my life, I've always had the desire. I didn't know how to go about it. I didn't follow the rules. I didn't do it perfectly. But at the time, I did it to the best of my ability. I honestly did it to the best of my ability. I'm so anxious to cut to the good stuff. I remember, I like telling this, I went to Par, and I got a speeding ticket driving there because I wanted some relief. And I'm miserable. I can't stand another day of this drinking and being up for a week, and I can't. It's killing me, and I know it's killing me, so I drove to Par. And actually, I kind of thought he'd let me off knowing where I was going, but he probably thought I was lying. You know, who's going to drive to rehab themselves? I got a speeding ticket for doing to Larry Lindsay Highway. Why he didn't tow my car, I don't know, but he actually let me go with the citation, and I went to par. I don't know if you've been there or not before, but they have a 9-point system. Every offense, you do something you're not supposed to do, it's 3 points. 9 points, they ask you to leave. I had 6 points my first day, I think within the first hour. When I walked in the door and the guy started telling me you're going to do this and you're going to do that and you got to do this, and I used a reference that I guess in jail would make them my girlfriend, let me just say that without saying it. And it was a rough 59 days after that, let me tell you that. Why I didn't leave, I don't know, because I guess they're seeing if you're serious, because they get paid by how many heads or how many beds are full at night, and the counselors would come out and show me the keys. So you can leave today if you want to, you know that. I asked them to hold my car keys till I left, and they would show them for me every day, seeing if I was serious about wanting to be there or not. And I don't know if you know Bob Age or not. I mean, Bob Age that runs the car center, first guy that's ever actually, I don't want to say out-talked me, because that would make it think that I'm smarter than everybody else. I was in survival mode. I had to defend myself any way possible, whatever it took. And Bob H. has actually dealt with people like me, apparently. I found out if you asked, that he would actually counsel people, but only if you asked, only if you went in and said, listen, I need some help. And so I went in his office and said, I need some help. And he said, you know, I'm a little busy right now. I'll come back tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And I'm living there, so I come back tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And he said, yeah, I don't feel like doing it today. Why don't you come back tomorrow about 3? That went on for about a week and a half. And I was so mad that I just kept going back, because I was mad. I was going to show him. And, you know, at the time I was having problems with substances, and I was in an alcohol house. And he did me a favor. You know, it just dawned on me that he did me a favor, because it was a different caliber. I don't want to say better or worse, just different caliber of people that were in the NA house at the time, or the drug house at the time. And I probably wouldn't have survived that or been able to go through that clean and sober. And so I went in and told him, listen, I paid money. I'm in an AA house, and I should be in an NA house across the street. And he said, what else can I do for you? And I had a couple other references. He said, well, I can assure you those are things that are not going to happen while you're here. So now what else can I do for you? And so everything I asked him for, he said, I can guarantee you that's not going to happen while you're here. He said, you know what, I'm done talking, come back tomorrow. And we went through that routine again for a little while. And he finally one day sat me down in his office, and he opened his drawer, and he pulled out a hammer, and he handed it to me. He said, you know what, why don't you just start whacking yourself in the head? I'm tired of listening to you already. But, you know, that's what you've been doing your whole life. You might as well just get it over with. And I'm thinking, hey, take a minute for help. And he said, you know what, people have been trying to help you your whole life, and you just keep sabotaging your own success, so just start whacking. And I'll never forget, he handed me the bottom of a cardboard with a case of the Coke used to come in a little cardboard tray, and he said, now hold this. And he took the tape off his desk, and he threw it across the room, right at me. And I remember making sure it didn't hit me, and he said, I made my point. People have been trying to help you, and all you do is keep blocking everything that somebody's trying to do for you. And it was the first time that I actually shut up and listened to what the guy had to say. And Bob H. Was probably one of the instrumental people in getting me to not kill myself from drinking and using. For example, you know, this program, it has some simple suggestions that survival for me was doing what I thought was best, what I thought was what came normal to me, what came natural to me, what wasn't offensive or wasn't out of line. Like at the parson, they ask you to work through the fourth step before you leave. One of the counselors there had a car that wasn't running, so I worked on his car for him, and he signed off the fourth step for me. He signed off the first four. So I didn't actually do any work when I was there. My story is actually, it's a better story of what not to do than what to do. I'm just now learning what to do to save myself, to become clean and sober. I can tell you for 28 years what not to do, what didn't work for me, what I didn't do, the suggestions that I didn't follow, the people that offered advice that I didn't take. I have 28 years of that, and it landed me drunk and loaded every time. People have been trying to help. It's funny, I read the big book now and I read things that, where did they put that in there? Spent it the whole time. I just didn't see it. Perception is everything. They were so glad to see me leave the PAR Center. I actually stayed. I stayed the 60 days. And this kind of guy was, I didn't want to be there. I was having a conflict with over something. And I found, I know what it was. They were yelling at us every day about maintaining the house, because I wasn't good at chores. I don't know about you, but when I was already in recovery, I was undisciplined, and I'll tell a little bit about that in a minute, but, you know, I didn't clean house. I just didn't do any of that. I just didn't take care of myself very well. And they were honest every day about chores in the house. This is your house. You pay for it. It's a government-run place. You need to take care of it. You need to keep it clean. You need to scrub the walls. You need to vacuum. You need to this and that. Well, I found some repair requisitions one day that if there was anything wrong with the house, they had to submit these to the main house, and you get things fixed. You know, if the light wasn't working or a faucet was leaking. Well, being in the construction trade for years, I went through that house top to bottom and found everything that was wrong with my house. My faucet was leaking, the paint peeling off the shower, the ceiling of my shower, the seam in my carpet coming apart, and they were so happy to see me go. My God, I was just a major pain in the ass survival for me, with deflecting anything from me back on anybody else that was around me. And Bob and I can laugh about that today. I have this saying, it was funny back then, but not ha-ha funny, you know. You know, I got out of PAR, I stayed clean and sober for a while, and then I actually had the neck surgery. And getting out of the neck surgery, I remember, you know, I was going to meetings at the time when I got in a car accident, and I knew that I knew what was going to happen when I got out of the hospital. It happened time and time again when I had broken bones. I asked somebody in recovery to take the medication, because I knew I was going to have to take it. I had a fused, they took bones out of my hip and stuck in my neck. I knew I was going to have problems, so I asked somebody in recovery who had numerous years to take care of my medication. And so I thought I had a game plan. I had somebody to take care of the dogs. I had things in line. And the day that I was supposed to get out of the hospital, this person came to the hospital who was going to assist me and said, I have to go out of state. There's an emergency in the family, and I can't do that for you. I'm sorry. And I remember being offended at the time and said, you know what, I'll just do it myself. Don't worry about it. And that was in 03. I had the accident in 02 and 03. I had the surgery. And I'm just now coming out of that fog thinking, you know what, I'll just do it myself. I don't need you. I'm self-sufficient. My best thinking just about killed me. So I stumbled back in and out of meetings. I would get a little bit of time. Anybody that knows me knows my story, knows that part of my family lives in Clovis. And there's an off-ramp on the freeway that I have spent probably 15 years not being able to get past. My experience in Traeger in New London is extensive. I drove there almost every day for 15 years. I sat out like a sore thumb there. But they like to see me because I brought money every day. For 15 years, I don't know how many I'm going to say. Mother's Day, Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter. I probably in 15 years made it a handful of times to those. I went every year. I attempted to go to Fresno, to Clovis, to those family functions, but I never made it past Traeger and New London off the freeway. If the cops were cruising around in Traeger, then I would just go to New London and vice versa. And I did that for 15 years. That's a hard life. That's a hard life. I have drank away so many houses and cars and relationships. And, you know, I used to be just upset because I didn't have I've not been married, I don't have any kids. And now I'm kind of thankful that I didn't, because I would have just continued that chaos that I experienced, and I would have wreaked havoc in other people's lives worse than I have already. By going to meetings, I've been asking people to sponsor me for 28 years. The only difference was I never called anybody. I had their phone numbers. I was a great starter and a very slow finisher. And some of those things turned out to to be John Shump in the long run, and I'll get to that. And the simple suggestions that the book of AA talks about, the simple suggestions, I have spent my life talking about what I'm going to do, telling people what I need to do, what I think I should do, what I'm going to do, and I've come to the conclusion that recovery in life is an action word. And I can honestly tell you I had the best intentions. I had every intention of staying sober for 20. I had every intention of doing that. I didn't want to get drunk or to get low. I didn't want to do that. And people offered the tools. I read the tools. I guess it took a long time for things to get out of my head and actually make it into my heart. And you hear people saying that from time to time. I was shut down emotionally. I could probably read the 12 steps without looking at the book. I know them inside and out. Knowing what the book says is not enough for me. I have to apply it to my life. And what happened to change that for me? Two things happened, and I'll only mention one of them, because I'm an auctioneer for a living now, and I don't know about you, if you've been an auction, most of those are fueled by open bars. It gets people to spend money, and they spend a lot of it and don't realize what they're doing. Not always. I mean, it's just a fun environment for people. Not everybody has the problem that I have. They can drink and have fun and not spend their whole life, or end up in Traeger when they're done. And I had the best intentions for years and years. I've totaled 3 cars on the way home from auctions, and I had no intentions of drinking when I left. My throat was a little sore, maybe a little whiskey would loosen up my vocal cords so I could do the auction. I had every intention of not drinking going to those events, but until recently did I realize what it took to not actually be able to do that. The last time that I went to a place to do an auction, and I like this story because the guy that's here, people have heard me tell this story before, but the guy that actually was instrumental in that is actually here tonight. Of all things, the reason I like this event and why it's so important that this gentleman's here, I've been a big brother to a kid, and this is partly a good story and partly something that I have to deal with. I've been a big brother for 23 years, but I've been sober for almost 16 months, 18 months. So he got to witness a whole lot of chaos in my life when I drank and did things I wasn't supposed to do. I stayed away from it. And to be a mentor to some young man and to have that history, although we're good friends, we always have been, you know, I have some things I'm not really proud of. So I'm doing an auction in Fresno for big brothers, big sisters. They call it the 300 Club. There's 300 men that gather once a year to raise money, the annual fundraiser, for big brothers. And all these men are involved directly or indirectly with the program of Big Brothers, Big Sisters. A lot of them have little brothers that they've mentored. And I didn't take any money that night because I didn't want to drink. I thought, if I don't have any of my money in pocket, I can take my ATM card, there's gas in my car, I can get there. There's no way. Just my luck. And party needs it's an open bar. Of course, my vocal cords need warming up a little bit. Bourbon and 7 was my favorite drink. Not really, you know, if you're drinking and using for 28 years, you haven't made a whole lot of close friends. You might have some acquaintances, but they don't know you well enough. I didn't let anybody get close enough to actually know who I was or what I was going through or, you know, that old saying we have, hey, how you doing? Great. How about you? You know, it's a crock. It was for me. Out in a room, this is the miracle of recovery. There's 300 men in the room. Now I haven't had a regular routine of eating breakfast, lunch, and dinner in my past behaviors. So all the hors d'oeuvres are out at this place, and I'm eating meatballs like no tomorrow. And a gentleman walks up and says, "You must be single, huh?" And I said, "You know, why in the hell would you say that?" And he said, "Because the way you're going after those meatballs, that must be dinner for you." And it was, I hadn't eaten in a while. And I'm not sure exactly how the conversation went, but he asked me, what are you washing down with? And I said, water, Pepsi, and something came up about alcohol. And I said, no, don't touch this stuff. And feeling I felt when he said, "Oh, I'm glad to hear that because I'm celebrating 19 years of sobriety, continuous sobriety tonight. How about you?" And it hadn't been 3 minutes since I had a bourbon 7. So what was in my mind was 3, so I said 3 years. And well, I don't know about you, if you know, when I realize I'm lying to complete strangers that could give a rip whether I did 3 minutes or my third drink, it didn't really matter. I didn't have to lie to this guy. We talked for a little bit, parted ways, and I'm thinking, what the hell, you know? The auction starts, and, it's, you know, the lighting, it was just the lighting of the room, like somebody was sitting right under a spotlight, and every time I looked out into the audience to do the live auction, all I could see is this guy sitting in the spotlight, and people were a little curious as to why I just turned the microphone off in the middle of my live auction and walked off the stage. Well, I walked out to the middle of the room and asked this gentleman if I could have his phone number. There was something I needed to get straight. And whether he knew at that time what I was talking about, I don't know, probably. I don't know. I've never asked him. But I walked off the stage, turned the microphone off, and said, "Listen, I need your phone number." We've been friends since that day. We were talking over dinner tonight about all the... I don't know, early sobriety for me was rough. We were talking at dinner tonight about all the people that were following me and spying on me, and we had a good laugh over at dinner over that. I would get lost. I mean, I'm hurt. I was burnt out. And when I told you I wasn't good at routines, chores, and stuff, I mean, this is how basic it was when I first got started. I would call him. I asked him to be my sponsor. I called him. Got his phone number. Called him. Told him the truth. And we kind of started working together. I asked him to sponsor me. And the difference was he lived in Madera. I lived here. And he'd asked me, "So you have a dog?" "Yeah." "Well, why don't you go out and pick up the dog crap in the backyard and then call me back when you're done?" "Okay." I call him back. "Have you done the dishes recently?" "No." "Why?" "Well, why don't you do the dishes and then call me back?" And that's how we started. That's how chaotic my life was. That's what got me back into, I became willing. I became willing to take some advice from somebody else. This is probably the biggest thing that has happened in my recovery or attempting to get sober. He said something that I have since learned that somebody said to him, and maybe people have said it before, I don't know, but he said to me, "Listen, I don't care what you've done or what you do or who you're not going to offend me. I love you regardless. It doesn't matter." It gave me the ability to tell the truth for the first time in my life and not be judged by it. I don't know about you, but that was a comfortable feeling. That was the first time it was like I left a monkey off my back. It was, I'll never forget that day. It doesn't matter what you say or do. It's okay. I care about you anyway. And that started my road to recovery. And shortly after that, the chaos, and I'm sure you had some ideas, but I wasn't, I don't know about you, but I lied in early recovery. I'm still not great at it right now. And I think he thinks that. I haven't asked him, but I'm pretty sure he had a clue that I was like, well, I was just a liar, a thief, and a thief. And since he lives in Madera, he asked me to find somebody closer to home to sponsor me because he couldn't look me in the eyes every day to see if what I was telling him actually jived. And so he said, "I need you to find another sponsor." And I remember going that day to the Blue Room. And I hadn't been to that Blue Room for a long time. 15 years I've been going in and out of that Blue Room. In fact, 10 years previous to going to that Blue Room that night, I went, and I didn't talk, I didn't share, I just stumbled in one more time like I've done for 20 some odd years of meetings. And another alcoholic, and this is a miracle of the program, I actually took a simple suggestion that somebody gave me, and I took the advice, I needed help, and I went to the Blue Room that Sunday night. And at the end of the meeting, anybody that knows me knows I'm working with Charlie. And at the end of the meeting, Charlie walks up to me out of the blue and said, "Listen, you asked me to sponsor you 10 years ago. Are you ever going to call me?" And I don't know how you even remember 10 years ago. But I took some simple suggestions from somebody who took an interest in my well-being. I took some advice. I followed that advice. I went. And I don't know that I would have asked Charlie that night because I was lost. I was still hurt. And Charlie said, "You know, you asked me to sponsor you. once you call me, let's get started. And I've been working with Charlie since that day. The difference in the past, when I read the book, The Paul Step, The Simple Suggestions, calling somebody, asking them what you think, I wasn't willing to attempt to do that. It's an effort. People that know me have heard me say this. The same time I started working with Charlie, I had a deaf Australian Shepherd, and if you know my story, I had a couple dogs that died while I was in my disease. They would come up and want some attention. I would brush them away. A couple dogs died from cancer, and they withered up and died, and I don't have regrets over that. I have a deaf Australian Shepherd now that comes up and wants to play, and the other dogs, I would tell them, they keep my lips moving, and me saying, you know, in a little while later, don't, you know, get away. And the dog I have now doesn't give a shit what my lips are saying. She knows when I get off the couch and grab the leash, I'm getting into action. And she doesn't give up regardless of what I say. My recovery's like that. I've told people I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Well, that Australian Shepherd, talk is cheap. When you see me at a meeting, you'll know I'm actually getting active in my recovery. When the dog knows I go get the leash, I'm getting active in my dog's life. Instead of just saying what I'm going to do, I just show up. When Bill asks, I just show up. When Charlie offers some simple suggestions, I follow those. Tonight, there was a concert. There was supposed to be a concert in town tonight. Some friends came down from the dare to go to this concert. We had dinner before. And my first impression was, you know what, I'm going to go to the concert with them. Charlie, hey, why don't you cover the meeting for me? I got reminded that, you know, listen, you make a commitment. In my old history, I make commitments and then bail on them all the time. You made a commitment. Why don't you have dinner with your friends and then come and do what you agreed to do? And, you know, I've become willing. Willingness for me is the key to my sobriety, to be able to take simple suggestions from people who have done it a whole lot better than I have, who have a lot more sobriety than I have, time-wise, and emotionally, intellectually, financially, they have more sobriety than I have. And by following some simple suggestions when I don't know what to do, I call somebody and ask them, what do you think? That's happened quite a few times in the last year and a half. I'll be driving somewhere, and like I drive, you know what? When I drive past the Traver exit today, I call somebody. Before I get to it, we're on the phone talking. Before you know it, I'm in Kingsburg, and I've made it to Fresno again. And I've been doing that for a year and a half now. When I go somewhere and things are a little out of sort, there's some alcohol there, there's something that I'm not comfortable with, I'll call somebody to talk about it. The difference is today, I became willing to follow some simple suggestions that are outlined in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The minute I became willing, things have happened for the better. Sometimes, you know, even the rough times today or just opportunities for... my friend Al's got a saying, I would call him, be mad as hell about something or somebody, people, places, and things, and his first time I heard this, I wanted to wring his neck. He said, you know what, that sounds like a great opportunity for spiritual growth. Not what I wanted to hear. It's what I needed to hear. It's not what I wanted to hear. Al and Charlie and Jose, you guys have saved my life. And I know you get to keep it by giving it away. I told Al I honestly wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for our running to each other and to partying. I was on my way out. I had enough. I was done. I was about at the end of the rope, literally. And because other people are active in their sobriety, it allowed me to become clean and sober and work my program on a daily basis. And I feel honored to be able to come up and talk, Bill. I want to say thank you for having me tonight. And if you're new, you know, for me, I had the desire to want to be clean and sober, and I just kept coming back. Regardless if I made mistakes, if I slipped, I had the desire in my heart. I don't want to live like that. I have potential as everybody does. And by not giving up, it's allowed me to be here tonight. And I want to say thank you. My name is Clint. I'm an alcoholic.